Accession number 18525, reel 1.
Colonel Smith, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Rangoon, Burma.
Which year was this?
1927.
You were just about to say 18th of November when I switched the tape off. How did you come to be born in Rangoon?
Well, my father worked for a company called White Away Laidlaw, which was pre-war a very large British company operating throughout the Far East, China, India, Ceylon, sort of Harrods of the Far East, if you like, sold everything from a pin to a car. And he was in Rangoon when I was born.
Did you have your upbringing and education in Rangoon?
No, I was attacked with a series of things called boils as a little lad, and had to be sent home with parents, not with parents, with relatives and friends. And in fact, I stayed in England until the outbreak, or just after the outbreak of war in 1939.
So whereabouts were you in England?
I was in Newcastle. Yeah.
Were you in Newcastle during the Second World War?
Well, no. What happened, when the war started, my mother got a flap on. By that time, they were in Malaya, having been moved. She got a flap on saying the Germans are going to come and bomb me, so we must get him out to Malaya, which took a year. Which I finally got to Malaya just in time for the Japanese to come in and kick us out to Australia. I then finished my education in Australia. Father was a prisoner of war with the Japanese. And I joined the British Army in Australia in 1945.
Can you describe your adventure in escaping from Singapore?
Well, we attacked by the Japanese first thing on a Monday morning, as I recall. I think the 8th of December, after Pearl Harbor. And for 5 days, Penang was bombed constantly. Father came home. He was in the local defense corps and said, right, pack a suitcase, you're on your way. We left by ferry on a Saturday night, finished up 2 days later in Singapore, straight under the hold of a ship, and the next thing we knew, we were in Batavia, or Jakarta as it is now, in Java, where we spent Christmas of that year, 1941. Sorry.
1941.
Christmas 1941, yes. All thinking we were going back to Malaya next week because the Japanese would be turned back, but as it happened, they weren't. So we put on another ship and dumped in Perth, Western Australia, Mother and I, where I went to work as a 13-year-old with no money coming in. I then decided later on, after a godfather turned up, who was a merchant navy man, said, you're not going to work, you're going to school, and I will pay. 4 years later, I said, well, I'm going to join the army to get father out of the prisoner of war camp in Singapore. I no sooner joined up than they dropped the atomic bomb, and they said, well, do you want to go? I said, yes, I'll go, and I went to India where I did my officer's training corps, leaving mother in Australia, where father eventually joined her after being released.
So you were in the Australian Army?
No, British Army. British Army recruitment team. We used to come round and I found them and joined up.
But this journey from Singapore via Batavia to Australia, did it all go smoothly?
No. We had, on the ship, coming out of Singapore, there were sailors from the HMS Repulse and the Prince of Wales, which had just been sunk. And they had these sailors on board with fixed bayonets to stop people jumping overboard. In fact, there were two or three women did jump overboard with their babies to try and get back to Singapore. Of course, it never did. But we were kept under hatches from then on, led up for a few minutes of fresh air and down into the hold again. And that was the journey from Singapore to Batavia.
What happened to the women who jumped overboard with babies? Were they fished out?
No, nothing stopped. We just went straight down south. I mean, all right, I was 12 and a half years old then. We thought it was a great adventure, but a lot of people were very, very distressed, as you can imagine. And on the ship also were people from Hong Kong who'd been evacuated. And what annoyed us was that all the kids from Hong Kong had all their toys and their trike bikes, which used to drive around. We had nothing, so sort of open war went on in a 12-year-old manner. And we stayed in Batavia with a Dutch family. They were very kind to us. And as I say, we thought we were going back to Malaya. Never did. And then the next stop was Perth, Western Australia.
But these women who jumped overboard, this was in Singapore Harbour?
Just as we left. 1 or 2 days out, yes. They just left the ship. You know, people were screaming at night. That's why the sailors were put on there, to try and stop them. Everybody was forbidden to go on the decks. And, pardon me, anybody who did was sort of told by the sailors to get downstairs again.
So this was because their husbands had been left behind?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what happened to them?
No. Never. In fact, we didn't know them. I mean, I wouldn't know who it was. We were just told that certain people had done it, and on the tanner, you are not allowed on the decks between the hours of so-and-so and so-and-so, and keep off, or you'll be forcibly put down below.
But for you, it wasn't traumatic.
Not really, no. We thought it was a great adventure, I suppose. Looking back, I suppose it was, but you know what kids of 12 are like when you get together? You think, well, this is great stuff, and roaming around the decks. And but we got to Australia, as I say, and we were taken in by an Australian. We lived in the Perth town hall for 2 or 3 weeks on sort of camp beds and blankets, and then Australian families took us in. And we went to an Australian family, and after that we moved into a flat of our own when some money came in from father's firm in London for mother.
So you lived in Perth?
Yes, in Perth, yep.
All through the war?
All through the war, yep. Mm-hmm.
Did the war much affect you as a schoolboy in Perth?
No. We had a large American flying base on the Swan River, which flew Catalinas. And the Americans were a good source of chewing gum and things like that. I always remember we had a Greek fruit shop near the house, and in the summer he used to sell off watermelons at a penny each at the end of the day, so we thought that was rather good as well. And there was no rationing or anything. We weren't hit by that whatsoever compared to people in England.
Did you ever think that the Japanese might invade Western Australia?
The North, yes. I mean, the Australians were very touchy about this, and they did get various raids, and of course Sydney was a miniature submarine raid, and Darwin was hit several times. But I think, all in all, down in Perth, we never thought it would get that far. You know, there's a lot of territory in here in Darwin, and we're all right, Jack, sort of thing. But as it happened, it so happened, it didn't come that way. So,
how did the Australians treat an English boy in the Second World War?
Great. I mean, I couldn't have had a better life. I say, when this godfather turned up, and I went to a place, a school called Scots College in Western Australia. I had a good education, thoroughly enjoyed it. It was half a mile from the beach in Cottesloe, and we used to take our sandwiches for lunch and go and swim. It was wonderful. Joined the school cadet force, and that sort of put my finger on the trigger and said, I'm going to join up. So I did.
And had you contemplated any other service apart from the army?
No. I was training at school to be a commercial artist, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I still do cartoons and things. Then all of a sudden I thought, well, this isn't helping the old man, and I'll go and do something about it. But of course I was a little bit late.
And did you have your eye on the artillery?
No. I joined up in Australia in a sort of general service corps, I think it was, whatever it was, badgeless, flew out to Colombo, still in battle dress. It was a bit warm, so they gave me a green uniform, flew me up to Dulali, which was the RA depot. They then found I put my age up by 6 months. I was too young to go to officer cadet school. I stayed in Dulali for 6 months, then went to Bangalore, which was the infantry training. And then from there back to Dulali for a 9 months artillery course.
How did you take to the training that you got in those early days?
Fine, no, I didn't mind it. I've always been fairly well disciplined. I enjoyed the cadet corps at school, and we were mixed up with all the Indian cadets. I think in our intake in Dulali there were one Australian, myself, one Anglo-Indian fella, and 22 Indians and then Pakistanis, who became Pakistanis, but we got on famously. I've met many of them since years ago, but I haven't met them since, and they suddenly rose to great ranks when I was still a lieutenant. They were sort of half colonels and colonels, these guys, in their own army. But
so when were you commissioned?
45, May 45.
Now, between the end of the Second World War and the Korean War, were you involved in any other conflicts?
Yes, I've had 2 years in... pardon me. After I was commissioned, I was sent 2 years in Malaya, where parents were still. So I had 2 years of jungle bashing against the Chinese communists. Came home to England. Was posted to a regiment in Preston, where incidentally I shot an elephant in Preston Railway Station, but I won't bore you with that story. And then all of a sudden, I was enjoying myself at a place called Sennybridge in South Wales. The battery was looking after a territorial army camp. And somebody said, "You're going to Korea, lad." So I was posted to 4-5 Field Regiment in Colchester.
And in what capacity did you serve in that unit?
I was a command post officer, a lieutenant. In those days, the Royal Artillery Battery had two troops of four guns. Each troop was commanded by a gun position officer, and the command post officer coordinated the fire of the two batteries, if it was a battery or above target.
How did that job suit you?
Very good. Enjoyed it very much. Again, we found it all very strange. In fact, you know, when somebody said, "You're going to Korea," I had to get the map out and say, "Where is that place?" And the war had just started. There were some troops from Hong Kong had gone there, but 2-9 Brigade, of which we were a part, were the first real formation to get into Korea in October 1950.
What preparations did you have to make for going out?
We had... the regiment was pulled together, and it was composed mainly of reservists. They're all reservists called up for the Korean War. And I think the regiment went out there with about 50 or 60% reservists because they didn't have the regulars. We were interviewing these chaps, and I remember now there's a lad from South Wales whose wife was disabled. He ran a post office, and he said, "I can't go to Korea." And he'd just been called up, so we signed his paper, and back he went to South Wales. And we then had a month's practice camp at West Down on Lark Hill Ranges, and then got on the the Empress of Australia, and off we went.
Were there any other hard luck stories regarding the reservists?
I'm sure there were. I didn't come into, I think probably officers senior to me saw them. I was only a lieutenant then, but we interviewed some of the, and then I passed them on to the hierarchy, who said, "Will you stay or you go?"
What was the mood of the reservists having to go to Korea?
Not terribly chuffed about it all, but I must say when we got there, they were great. They were absolutely superb. I mean, I had 6 or 7 in my battery command post staff out of about 10, and they were great. They were really great. Moaned like hell all the time, but everybody did, and that's a soldier's prerogative.
What was the journey like to Korea?
Empress of Australia, we went out, the regiment was there, and brigade headquarters, headquarters 29 Brigade, and off we went, and we got to Pusan, and the Pusan military band marched up and down, American style, and the girls threw oranges up to us, and the soldiers threw the oranges back at the girls on the dockside, and then they said, "Get off, but you're going to the railway station in Pusan." We got there, onto the train. The train had no windows, no doors, piles of blankets on the floor, and they said, "You're off north."
Did you say this was October?
Yeah. And about 3.5 days later, we eventually got up to a place called Suwon. The journey now takes, I think, 6 hours, but it took 3.5 days in those days, and that was it.
What were your first impressions of Korea?
Not great, I can tell you. It was getting cold, although not nearly as cold as it got afterwards, but we got to Suwon, and then we're camped in a schoolhouse, a school complex, our battery, the regiment was around the town somewhere. Found out, of course, the guns had gone on one ship and the ammunition on another, so we had to wait around for 3 weeks till we finally matched up and sent some drivers back down to Pusan to get the guns and bring them up.
How did this kind of inefficiency occur?
Don't ask me, but these things do happen. Things like Suez as well, you know.
Why did the soldiers throw the oranges back at the girls?
Well, they didn't want to be in Korea for a start. They said, well, we don't like it, threw them back. You know what soldiers are like. I mean, it was no malice at all, but they just thought, well, I don't want your oranges, you can have them back, sort of thing. And this South Korean marching band was going up and down playing good Yankee tunes, and that didn't please the boys either. And one amusing story, I've got to tell you, we're on this train, it kept stopping for some unknown reason. And the colonel, we found a little interpreter lad, and they're all over the place. And they could speak quite good English, these little kids, so we adopted him as the colonel's interpreter. And he said, you tell that train driver, before he starts again, he's got to blow his whistle. Because people were doing things at the side of the track. So he told him this, and the next time it stopped, everybody got off. Then all of a sudden, Pete went the whistle, the train went straight away, and left the padre, who was about 100 yards away in a sort of frozen paddy field, doing what people have to do first thing in the morning. But the train was supposed to stop again while he got his trousers on and got on board. But lots of amusing incidents, but pretty uncomfortable.
So you said you arrived at Suwon eventually?
Suwon, yes, south of Seoul.
What happened there?
We waited there till the guns came along. We then moved up to Seoul. Had Christmas there, and then all of a sudden the balloon went up, the New Year thing, and off we shot with the brigade up north, and everybody got dusted up a bit, and we came back south of the Han River.
Before that, what was Christmas like in Seoul?
Well, we found a Christmas tree. I got pictures of the signal sergeant going up and decorating with all sorts of things. We came across a shooting of people by the South Korean police who didn't like these people at all. They said they'd been collaborators and they were shooting, and somebody waded in and stopped it.
From your unit?
Oh yeah, somebody from the battery went down and they stopped this, and they said, look, these are better guns than yours, and the South Korean police pushed off.
So what happened to the intended victims?
I don't know, they just disappeared and we couldn't put up with them. We managed to catch a pig, which we thought might be good for Christmas, and the farmer came around and said, I think you've got a pig. And our signal sergeant, a very good, no, the Remy sergeant, no, we haven't got any pigs. This thing was going squeak, squeak, oink, oink in the back of his Remy van, but we persuaded him it was just one of our tools being used, and off we went and had the pig for Christmas. So we did our own share of something, I suppose. But
did you know this chap who intervened to stop the execution?
No. No, he's one of the, in fact, he was a battery sergeant major from another battery, and he was just wandering around with the lads. We used to go out pheasant shooting. Pheasants were glorious. They'd never been killed in 2 or 3 years, and they were fat, and we used our American carmine rifles and shot a few to make a difference in the rations. But we had no tents. We all lived in our trucks. It was getting colder and colder, and by that time it was cold. The boots we'd been issued with, boots frostproof, boots FP, were white. Mine were dated 1927, the year I was born. I wore them for 2 days and they fell apart, so we went back to the good old ammunition boot. By that time, we'd contacted, or made contact, or we, I say various people, with the Americans, and the NAFI had arrived, and I think an officer was allowed a bottle of whiskey a month, and the sergeant's half a bottle. Well, a half a bottle of whiskey would get you what we call a squad tent and a space heater. And that's where the rations went on. And I mean, this is great. I mean, they were lovely. And otherwise, you know, you just froze.
So what was morale like by now?
Morale was very high. I think it always is. I mean, if things are down in the army or the services, morale is high. And of course, this depends to a great deal on your senior NCOs, who are quite magnificent. I mean, the officers are only training. The young officers under an NCO, but a good senior NCO, you know, is worth his weight in gold.
Now, you were talking about the Chinese offensive of New Year.
Yep.
Can you tell me in detail, step by step, what happened to you once that Chinese attack
occurred? Well, we were north of the river, and things were a bit haywire. Nobody really knew what was going on. And then it started, and everybody moved back very quickly. The infantry took a few casualties, but in the main, it was just a quick move back. What was the name of that? Compo Canyon was the name we were in. And we dug in and everything else. And it was very hard work digging guns and command posts in. And in the main, we didn't bother, but somebody said, you better dig in. We left there, and I came out leading the battery about 11 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden, my truck was surrounded by little people in funny uniforms. And I thought, well, I don't know who you are, but I'm not stopping. So I said to the driver, drive on. And in fact, there were South Korean soldiers, but it could have been, you know, open fire with anybody. We just drove and off we went. And we then had a fairly quiet time until, of course, the St. George's Day thing in April, which was the big shebang.
This is the Battle of the Imjin.
The Battle of the Imjin, yeah.
Where exactly were you located yourself?
A village near called Sol Marie, which in fact was south of the Han River. We were about 3,000 to 5,000 yards behind the infantry brigade. I've got the deployment, I've got a picture upstairs of it all. And there were various rumours going around. Things were fairly quiet, and then it started that mass movements were seen of Chinese, and nobody really believed it because this had been told before. And then the evening before St. George's Day, the whatnot hit the fan, as they say. And we fired all night, hundreds and hundreds of rounds. The Chinese got down into the gun position within burp gun range. So the guns were firing over open sights to get rid of them while we were still supporting the brigade. The Gloucesters got cut off, of course. The rest got back through. We had the Belgians with us then as well then. And it was fairly chaotic. And that, I think, is probably the one time where I say I was a bit scared. As we were mortared as we came out were these Chinese sitting on the hill. And they were too close for my liking. I mean, I didn't join the infantry, I joined the gunners. But, you know, we were doing that sort of thing. And then it was 3 days of turmoil. Back, you know, open sights and everything else. And then finally it all sort of settled down and we started counting our losses. And, of course, the Gloucesters were more or less written off. We lost all our observation post officers who were with the Gloucesters. Lost one or two more. And it was all very quiet till we went back up north again. The brigade was put out of action completely. The infantry, they just couldn't cope. So our CO was a bit gung-ho, volunteered worth to the Americans, and they said, come along with us. So we went along with 25 US Division.
Just going back, when the Chinese first pushed the artillery back, how close did the Chinese infantrymen come to your battery?
There's a picture upstairs by Cuno, about 400 yards, I should think, which is a bit too close. And while most of the guns were firing in support of our own infantry, two guns were over open sights. Fortunately, they never got under the gun position because off they went. And then some Centurion tanks came up, added their firepower, and off they went back over the hill. But they didn't go very far, and then we left.
What caliber of guns were firing over open sights?
25-pounders. Which is a very good gun, worth its weight in gold in Korea, I can tell you. The Americans are most impressed, that little old thing you've got that the gun goes around 180 degrees, just like that. They were great, and they did sterling work. And, they really were. But, you know, we fired everything we had. I mean, firing armor-piercing rounds at nothing, just in the hope that at the other end it might hit somebody or something.
In what kind of numbers were these Chinese who were 400 yards away?
Oh, I think couple of hundred, I suppose. It was a sort of large infantry meandering, but of course they'd got through all the 2-9 brigade lines by then. You know, cut the Gloucesters off, got behind the Fusiliers, got behind the Belgians, and just kept going south. And of course they had nothing to carry, just their burp gun, padded suits, bag of rice, and they could go like mad, scampering around.
And so the firing over open sights just dispersed them?
Yes, it did, yeah. They went. Yeah. I mean, they didn't get far because they were still mortaring, but we were then told to pack up and get the hell out of it down south. So we moved about 4 or 5 miles south.
What opinion did you form of these Chinese infantry at that time?
Well, we found one about 40 yards from my command post. And I remember my Sergeant Pledger, who was reservist, very cynical guy, said, he went outside, middle of all this, he said, there's a funny bloke about 20 yards away sitting on his haunches with a burp gun. I said, well, bring him around. So I brought this kid around, he looked about 14, and they gave him a cigarette, and he had a big smile, took his burp gun and said, push off. So off he went. And that was it. You know, they were like Ottomans, they didn't, and of course they blew their whistles and banged their bugles, but they had no, pardon me, air support or artillery support. They were just let loose, and these guys could roam around for days.
So you just let him go?
Yeah, we just let him go. I mean, we couldn't do anything about it. I wasn't carry a Chinaman in my command post truck when I was being told to bug out. I said, well, you can go and find your own home somewhere else, lad, and off he went.
But you took his weapon from him?
Oh, he took his weapon, yeah. I don't know what happened to that. I got chucked in a ditch somewhere. And when we moved further south, about 2 miles, one of the sergeant majors said, there's a so-and-so Chinaman with a machine gun behind our troops. So he turned the gun around and over open sights, had a go at this guy and or two of them, and blew him out of the way. It was all chaotic. I mean, people really... The only radio networking, I think, was between the gunners and the brigade commander. And there's a big fuss about whether you should hold or move. And I remember now, and I won't say who it was, because it's one battalion commander telling the brigadier that he should know what he's doing, they can't hold on. The brigadier saying, no, you must. And all of a sudden he said, no, you can get out, by which time it was too late. And that was the last communication we had between the infantry who on our regimental net and brigade.
But did the artillerymen, British artillerymen, have a high or a low opinion of the Chinese infantry?
Well, the artillerymen never really saw them. There was only this swarm coming over the hill. And as far as we were concerned, they put half a dozen rounds from a couple of guns under their feet and they went. But they thought they're too damn close. I mean, as they also said, we didn't join the infantry. You know, we should be a bit back from all this.
And then you had 3 days going back. What were conditions like on that?
Well, it was stopping, firing, stopping. Nobody knew where anybody was. We crossed over the back across the river, and it was just really it was just a day began and a day finished when you just went on and on firing, stopping, firing, and really information was very, very slack because nobody knew where anybody was. I think. Because by that time, the Chinese had got all round the place, up the mountains, round the mountains, and...
Were you getting air support?
Yes, we got air support, but the weather was bad. It was very foggy, and I remember it was Detroit to get to the Gloucesters, but I think it was a Puerto Rican tank battalion, which rather puzzled me. I think it was Puerto Rican, but they didn't get very far. They had to turn back. But the air support, I think, was coming for the infantry. We didn't need it. We were 2 or 3 miles back. We were all right, Jack, sort of thing. But all we could do was, you know, stop, unhitch the guns, fire a few rounds, and get going again. Because it was movement, movement all the time.
So you went back for 3 days, stopped, and then went forward again?
Well, we stopped then, and things calmed down, and then we moved forward, mainly to recce what was going on. Things got very quiet then because we were south of the River Han, south of Seoul, and things were just fairly dormant. And they stayed dormant while we went with the Americans. As I say, the colonel didn't want his guns idle, and we were attached to an American.